The White House lays out a plan to overhaul the mortgage market.
Is it enough or too much?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's February 11th. Coming up, House Republicans go back to the cutting board. In Illinois, the state license plate could double as metal billboard. And later, if somewhere is Germany, then over the rainbow is a big pot of gold records.
But first, let's get to the report that's out this morning from the White House on the future of Washington's role in the mortgage industry.
Former Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr is with us now on the line to talk about it. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
What does the government want to do in this situation?
Well, I think what you're going to see the Treasury Department doing in the coming months is begin to set a new foundation for a more resilient and stable housing finance system, and importantly, to have a firm and stable regulatory system so that we don't have races to the bottom like we saw in the lead up to the financial crisis.
How long is this going to take to unwind, and can this be done without affecting the market in a drastic way?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Federal Housing Finance Administration, FHA, account for more than 9 in 10 mortgages in the country today. And I think everybody agrees that that was necessary during the financial crisis, but that over time that role needs to be scaled back. I think if it's done in a slow and measured way, it should be able to be absorbed by the marketplace without disrupting the housing recovery that we're beginning to see now.
How could this change the way people buy homes?
I think you're going to see a greater emphasis, for example, on more down payment. If we move to a system in which there's no government guarantee in the future, mortgage rates will rise rather sharply. And I think we're going to see a shift away from the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. It'll be much harder for people to get that product, and you'll see a lot of people with adjustable rate mortgages. I think that would be unfortunate.
Former Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr, thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
And let's get some analysis now from our Friday regular guest, Chris Lowe. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, and he's with us now from New York. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So what's your reaction to what David just reported?
Yeah, look, I think this was a very rational response to a crisis that was not just a financial crisis, but also a housing crisis. We learned in a very painful way that not everyone should be a homeowner, that in fact, for many homeowners, that mortgage became a terrible millstone around their necks. I also agree, we don't necessarily need Fannie and Freddie anymore, that the mortgage market is coming back. It's healthier than it was before. And I think we will still have a housing recovery without them.
Well, if we don't need them, then why have we kept them for so long?
Well, look, you know, I think everyone in Washington agrees Fannie and Freddie have to go. They're not popular with the public. Getting rid of them, great idea. But everyone in Washington is also terrified if housing takes another dive as a result of shutting them down, they could lose their jobs. And for that reason, they're all scared to pull the plug.
All comes back to politics. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The first proposal this week for spending cuts amounted to about $35 billion, and that wasn't enough for conservative Tea Party members. So today, the leaders of the House Appropriations Committee will release a spending plan that has cuts worth twice that much. As Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, the fight over these steep cuts could lead to a government shutdown.
Newly elected conservative Republicans sent appropriators back to the drawing board to find deeper cuts than they originally proposed. Gary Bass at OMB Watch says spending cuts at this level will cost jobs.
Most of these government programs that are being cut come out in the form of grants or contracts to various groups to carry out the work. It means those people can no longer hire people, let alone that they may have to lay people off.
The House will have to reach some accommodation with the Senate and White House by March 4th when the temporary budget expires. Budget writing veteran Pete Davis says House Speaker Boehner may not be able to avoid a government shutdown.
What's he going to do when he can't get enough spending cuts to satisfy the Tea Party members of his caucus?
Davis expects Congress may end up temporarily extending the current budget, kicking the can down the road again. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, February 11th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. I'm on Twitter as well, at Jeremy Hobson. Don't forget, you can also get the latest look at the markets by checking out the numbers section at marketplace.org. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
To Egypt now, where the situation is changing by the moment and where protests against the Mubarak government continue to drive much economic uncertainty there in the Middle East. The BBC's Magdi Abdelhadi is with us from Cairo this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
The Egyptian stock market was supposed to open this weekend. Some businesses had resumed business last week. How are these latest developments factoring into those items?
There are violent confrontations, so I can expect the stock market to maybe postpone opening on Monday. All businesses will be worried. I mean, I noticed that some businesses that were supposed to be open, basically shops on the street, did not open in anticipation possibly of some trouble. So clearly any prospect of protracted crisis will impact negatively on the economy at large and even small businesses.
These additional protests, are they prolonging the uncertainty there?
I would think so. This country relies heavily on tourism. And having come to some kind of a standstill, tourists aren't simply coming to Egypt out of fear of violence, and things might get even worse. And generally, you know, businesses like stability and predictability. And Egypt seems to have neither of these two factors at this stage. So it's hardly surprising that the country is losing so much money and may even lose more if the uncertainty continues and things get even more unstable.
The BBC's Magdi Abdelhadi joining us from Cairo. Magdi, thank you.
You're most welcome.
The repercussions are extending beyond Egypt's borders, too. More protesters have gathered in Amman, Jordan. And that's where we find Marketplace's own Elisa Roth joining us on the phone. Hi, Elisa.
Hello.
Sounds like a lot of people there are reacting to this news as well. Explain where you are.
Embassy. There are a couple of hundred protesters, I'm going to say 200 to 300 protesters, who've come after the big afternoon prayer session. They have come ostensibly in support of the Egyptian people. They were chanting things earlier like Mubarak, depart, depart. So people are definitely upset. This is also in some measure a protest against Jordan and saying we want reform here as well.
What about businesses in the region, Elisa? What's going on there?
Well, today is Friday, but it is in the Middle East as if it were Sunday. It's the day of prayer, and businesses are actually shut. But I think what is clear is that the continued uncertainty is making everybody from investors to the people on the street nervous, and that's always bad for business.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth and Amman. Elisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
The world's biggest maker of mobile phones, no, not Apple, I'm talking about Nokia. The Finland-based company has had a hard time keeping up in the world of smartphones, so today it's announcing that it's teaming up with Microsoft. Under the deal, Nokia smartphones will run Windows Mobile software, as Christopher Worth reports now from London.
Nokia was the darling of the mobile phone industry when it was just about making phone calls. But the company has struggled to compete in the era of smartphones. At one point, more than half of all smartphones were Nokias. But since Apple launched its iPhone in 2007, that's been cut in half. Nokia's phones are neither cool, nor do they offer the same apps and services as Apple's iPhone. Jeff Blaber is with CCS Insight in London. He says today's deal with Microsoft is essential if the company is to stage a comeback.
Nokia are nowhere in the American market, and that market is absolutely essential for Nokia to get a foothold in.
And he says this is a major coup for Microsoft as well. Even though Nokia is struggling, because the company is still so big, the deal helps Microsoft capture a big share of the mobile software market that today is dominated by Apple and Google. Microsoft currently only has a 2% share of the mobile market. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Lawmakers in Illinois, Jeremy, that's your home state, isn't it?
Home state,
yeah.
Yep.
Are looking for myriad ways to get some revenue into state coffers.
I bet.
Yeah, terrible budget crisis there in Illinois. One idea they're talking about, tossing around in the State House, selling advertising on license plates.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Maybe the car in front of you could advertise, granola bars? deodorant, cereal.
Yeah.
The legislator from Chicago that came up with the idea said the state has to start thinking outside the box, or in this case, inside that big metal rectangle.
Well, you know, Steve, I just have in my mind somebody who gets an advertising on their license plate of some product that only lasts for a little bit of time, like Crystal Pepsi, and then they end up driving around in their car for years and years and years.
Unless they change the license plate, which will cost money.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, February 11th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. A lot of songs shoot to the top of the charts and then disappear. You probably know those one-hit wonders. Well, some songs keep reappearing. Reporter Caitlin Carroll tells us about one tune that's been around for quite a while, and in a new version is lighting up the German pop charts.
Somewhere over the rainbow
has been covered by about 100 different musicians since the song was first released in 1939. But no one has sold as many singles as the Hawaiian musician Israel Kamakavi'iole, or Iz for short.
Even though it is somehow melancholic, it has a very positive message and positive feeling. People can hear it even when they're on the other side of the planet in a car, driving to their work.
Wolfgang Boss is the owner of B1 Recordings. He's responsible for bringing Over the Rainbow to thousands of German car radios 17 years after the song's initial release. The singer, Iz, died in 1997, but this past fall, Boss lobbied Iz's small Hawaiian label for an exclusive licensing deal in Germany. After a $100,000 marketing campaign, the song made it to number one on German charts for 12 weeks. He says it sold
altogether more than 750,000 singles
and spawned a kind of fever for the song's signature instrument, the ukulele. Many music stores are starting to sell out, and the main ukulele fan club in Germany has grown to 2,600 members. In the back room of a small restaurant in Berlin, about 20 ukulele aficionados sit around drinking beer and practicing. I sit down next to a guy who goes by the name Uku Klaus.
Israel, the Thunder Over the Rainbow, that starts my interest to play this little instrument.
And interest in the song has spread to France, where it's now number one on the charts. Wolfgang Boss says Japan is next. This version of Over the Rainbow seems to land on a pot of gold every time. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
We have other versions of the song, by the way, at marketplace.org.
Well, Steve, when you think of the Secret Service, what do you think of?
I think of those guys with the earphone, you know, the little plug yep. in their ears, and they're very
guarding
serious,
the president.
Serious well, people.
That's right. Well, you know, they also have another task besides guarding top-level government officials, and that is safeguarding the nation's financial infrastructure or cracking down on currency counterfeiters.
Mm.
Just this week, they were very busy. Authorities nabbed a guy trying to use a fake $50 bill in West Virginia and two people with more than $13,000 in counterfeit money in Maryland. Now, this is nothing new, of course. Counterfeiting has been going on in this country even before it was a country. And Ben Tarnoff knows all about that. He's just written a book on the history of counterfeiting in the U.S. It's called Moneymakers, and he's here to talk about it. Hi, Ben.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So you tell a lot of great tales of counterfeiting that was going on back in the early days of the Republic. Just give us an idea of the kind of thing that was happening and who was doing it.
So on the one hand, you have to be a very talented artist to be a good counterfeiter. You'd have to engrave an entire piece of copper plate and then ink that plate and run it through a printing press. On the other hand, you have to be aggressively entrepreneurial. You have to think about which communities are best suited to the production and distribution of counterfeit notes.
And you can't just do it right in the middle of a city.
Well, you couldn't. The first counterfeiter profiled in my book is named Owen Sullivan, and he gets into quite a lot of trouble in 1749. He's having a drunken argument with his wife. It's a hot day in Boston. And at one point, his wife yells, "You 40,000-pound moneymaker." Moneymaker is the colonial word for counterfeiter. So the neighbors overhear this and call the authorities. So you're right. Cities at that period were actually very difficult to be a good counterfeiter.
All this sort of brings up a bigger point, I guess, which is that the value of money is only worth the paper it's printed on when it comes down to it. Why do you think we have so much faith today in our dollar bills?
The dollar bill, now that we've completely unhinged from the gold standard, relies entirely on our confidence in it and in the confidence of the credit of the United States. And the real truth about confidence, though, is that it's always sustained American currency, even in the 18th and 19th century, because often the promise to redeem a piece of paper for gold and silver was imaginary.
I have to admit, I have never seen a counterfeit dollar in circulation, at least that I knew of. Have you?
I have, but there's a reason for that, because counterfeit notes actually amount to a small number of the total in circulation. It's about 1 per 10,000 notes, both at home and abroad.
Ben Tarnoff, author of Moneymakers, a new book about the history of counterfeiting in America. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find Moneymakers as well as all the latest books on business and the economy on our big book blog at marketplace.org. Hmm. And Steve, while we're talking currency, a Republican lawmaker in South Carolina has introduced a bill to study whether the state, the Palmetto State, should create its own currency of gold and silver coins. State Senator Lee Bright says people have more faith in those metals than they do in the U.S. dollar these days. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, neither does a former Fed economist in South Carolina who says, you know, if people want to hedge against inflation with gold and silver, they could always just buy gold and silver.
There is a way to do that.
That's one thought. Yeah, it's a good idea. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Again, the website, marketplace.org. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.